all the money, but 2 years from now, say the city of Talkeetna could expect to get on that list. Do you have that sort of thing?
For the APA list for the 5 years.
Pending appropriation.
We don't compensate.
Madam Chairman, I've just been informed that we have a 5-year list for the EPA funding, for the federal funding, but we do not for the state. Essentially, what we do for the state funding is, as we said to Senator Halford, is that we send out this year's criteria, which hopefully is relatively consistent but also improved. I mean, we do make modifications of it each year if we can. It can be pointed out there's a better way to rank things, and then the communities resubmit every year for placement on that list. I would say that there's probably a rough congruity between the two, but there's no guarantee. In other words, we don't say that 3 years from now we know the needs statewide will be such that your project will get funded. But I think you can sort of see that as the top ones get funded, the other ones do bump up unless somebody comes up with a new project that, according to the criteria, would be deemed more important. We do have instances where that might occur. For example, if we do have an outbreak, a public health problem outbreak, that will change a community's priority dramatically. For example, in Southeast Alaska, we have the possibility of Giardia outbreaks at any time for those water systems that are surface. Most of them do not have the type of treatment that would prevent that outbreak. Unfortunately, Ketchikan had such an outbreak. The fact that it went from the potential to the actual will change its priority next year dramatically.
Well, just a statement from myself, then. If you develop a criteria that obviously is subject, in particular in your field, to change because of other hazards, weather conditions, whatever, the communities, though, to the maximum extent possible, ought to be able to start planning and depending upon your 5-year plan. I noticed in the Department of Highways for the last generation, when you've gotten near the top of the 5-year plan, all of a sudden, for no reason you could imagine, you were down at the bottom of the next 5-year plan, and you never did get to the top if you were a small community. Hence, I hope that you'll do what you can to structure a plan that the communities can depend upon, of course, always subject to appropriation and subject to emergencies which occur, and real true emergencies, not just in politically invented ones.
Right. Madam Chairman, what I would offer to Senator Katula is that we could do some research over
I have no complaints with you.
Whatever happened, though. I mean, I would like to know whether or not we can see a trend that you do sort of move up the list as the top ones get funded. And so we could check that out just in a rough sense and see if there is any reliability in the process. And if not, I could certainly entertain what you just said, is whether or not we could change our process to give a sense of assurance over one fiscal year.
Okay. Any more questions on old projects? Can we go? Yes, sir. Senator Fisher.
On the sheet that you just passed out, these are old projects. Appropriation balance, is that the money you're referring to that can be reappropriated?
Yes. In some instances, that's the case. We would need to go through each project with you and assure that is the case. I wouldn't want to say that the numbers that I gave you are exactly the same as if you total up the appropriation balance in all the projects, but generally that's true.
No further questions. Let's go to Volume 2, the Governor's Proposed Capital Budget, and ask the Commissioner about those projects that are in the Governor's Proposed Capital Budget for 1986. Volume 2. DEC is the first one. Your hand is on it, Senator. Right.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, sir.
We have essentially three capital project categories that I'd like to talk about now. As I said, we have our 50% municipal grant match program. The governor has requested $10.1 million approximately for these. We have a list of the named communities. These came from our prioritization list. Essentially, what the governor did was go down the list until we ran out of money based on the estimates of what the projects would cost, and then that's it. And there are If we were to receive that amount of money and we remained within the concept of named communities, that's what we would indeed fund. The second is the Village Safe Water Priority List Program. $2.3 million is approximately what the governor has recommended for that.
Commissioner, could you explain the Village Safe Water Program for us? Do you have the same kind of criteria? Do communities apply for that? How does that work?
Yes, Madam Chairman. It is essentially the same. I'll refer to Gary as to whether or not the criteria are precisely the same. I would assume they're slightly different to take into account the different needs that might occur in the villages. For example, we do have a category of those communities, those villages that have no existing services at all, those that have some that need upgrade, etc. And for example, on this list, all of the communities that were named indeed have no water and sewer.
Could you point those out to us, sir?
Yes, I've got page 66 is what mine is referenced to. I assume that's the same on yours.
No, we have the Village Safe Water Priority Circle Community Water.
That's right, Healy Lake.
Those,
right.
And these communities, all of these communities have no water facilities at all?
Yes, they're still
the whole list, Diomede, Galvin, Healy, Calce, Kiana.
Yes.
I am on page 2 of the DEC's capital budget summary of the governor's. I'm on page 2. I'm under village safe water priority. Okay, my other question now is why did you pick and choose among them? If that whole category there, the village safe water priority, none of those communities have any existing hardware, I guess, right?
Essentially, that's
how did you pick and choose among them then? Because some of them haven't been funded.
I'll refer to Gary on that one, Madam Chairman.
The way that we came up with our communities to put in the capital budget, we followed concurrent resolution 101, which was passed several years ago by the legislature, which directed the department to deal with the 12 regional health corporations and determining what our priorities were. So back in August, we contacted the 12 health corporations and asked them what were the greatest needs in each of the areas that they're responsible. They came back with this list of 18. They came back with 18 communities. There are not 18 communities in that list. From the 18, we grouped those into three categories. The category A were those communities that had no sanitation projects. Category B were the projects that had something, but it was not fully operational, or there were potential health problems that existed. Our funds were available, but not enough money was available to finish a project. And then the third category of projects were those communities that had some facilities, but the community wished to upgrade the level of service. They had a watering point. They would like to have a pipe watering system. Of that group, that total request that we put together to the governor's office was $17 million. Of that, the governor chose only to fund or put in his capital budget bill only those projects that did not have any level of service, which are those projects that are listed there. Those
eight. After our consultation with the health corporations, all of the projects that they identified as needing something were what indeed ended up in the capital budget.
Well, I think the point I'd like to make here, and the reason I've asked for an in-depth discussion of this, is my community, I don't think, my constituents, have no idea that there are places in Alaska that have no kind of watering hardware at all. And I wanted this to be brought out. Senator Halford?
Madam Chairman, there will always be places in Alaska where there are communities that have no kind of public sewer and water systems. I think at some point in size, you have to look at per capita cost. Not so much to communities, but I think most of the people in Alaska do realize there's lots of places with no public water.
Senator Ferguson?
I'd like to mention for Senator Halford that we have some communities in the state that have voted not to put in an expensive system, but they would like to have a watering point.
Like Benatang.
And this is the whole idea behind the Safe Water Act, I believe.
Madam Chairman, the next...
Excuse me, Senator Howe. I'm sorry, Senator Howe. I'm a city slicker. These things just amaze me. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, the next category, we have Village Safe Water, various statewide projects. Again, there are many projects that would qualify as being of need. The governor selected three of them. And essentially, he did that in the course of his own preparation of the capital budget and put in communities that would provide the kind of statewide balance that he felt was necessary in his overall capital budget. Our priority system did not necessarily reflect in those choices explicitly. Then, Madam Chairman, we have three items in the capital budget that I'd like to touch on. We have what is known as our oil spill reserve account fund. This was established by the legislature in the mid-1970s at a $1 million level. It is to be used by the department to clean up oil spills on an as-needed basis, and then under the law we are to seek liability and to be repaid if at all possible.
Commissioner, is that what you're calling your spill expense reserve?
Yes.
It's funded at $550,000?
Yes, ma'am. And essentially what has occurred is that that account is down to about $400,000, and it is to, according to the enabling legislation, it is to be at $1 million level. We have had previous appropriations. In 1981, we had $250,000 put back in the fund, and in 1984, we had another $250,000. We've essentially recovered over the life of the fund about $1 million, Madam Chairman. So essentially, we've had the original appropriation was $1 million. We've had $500,000 put in. We've had $1 million in costs brought back, and we've got about $1.5 million in, that we have used over the life of the fund as cleanup. So we need essentially another $500,000 to go back up to the $1 million that the fund needs to be at so we can respond to oil spills over the course of the coming year. And then again, we will pursue each spill in an attempt to get established liability and get reimbursed for the cleanup costs. That goes back to the general fund, and essentially then when we get low, we come to you and say, could you put it back up?
Senator Ferguson has a question, Commissioner.
Mr. Ross, again, to your director, I think in the city of Pottsville had an oil spill that they're trying to clean up, but I don't see anything in the budget for that. Was there any discussion with the city of Cottsville in doing this?
If I might try that one, since I've had some conversations with other staff in it, but I would urge Gary to put a book in my mouth if I'm saying what's wrong. The city of Cottsville, we have had discussions with them, and it was my understanding that they were going to seek a direct appropriation from the state for the cleanup of that spill. If our fund is used, Senator, to clean that up, then we would have to seek liability and get reimbursement for it. So if, for example, the city was deemed liable because of the location of the spill or the ownership or whatever, then they would have to pay us back. So it was my understanding they were going to seek a direct appropriation, and that would not necessarily come through the department to do that.
Are there any further questions?
The next item, Mr. Chairman, would be what we're calling our natural resources combined laboratory planning and design. We have a laboratory here in Juneau. It's our chemical laboratory. It is located over in an old school building that the city and borough own in Douglas. And this building is decrepit is the best word that can be used to describe it. And our lease runs out in October of this year. And the borough has indicated that, A, they don't want to put any money into the building to rehab it, and that they would like us to vacate it as soon as possible. This would necessitate us finding new space. The Forest Service is building a laboratory out at, near Ock Bay, and they, with discussions with the department, have agreed to modify their design and make this a joint laboratory between ourselves and their forest science activities in Southeast Alaska. And so this money would go to redesign their existing design and then to await the money that might be necessary. The university is involved in this as well, so it would be a three-way laboratory between the university, the Forest Service, and ourselves. And the total cost savings, if these three laboratories were combined over individual labs being constructed, would probably be $2 or $3 million when the building is finally built. So this would enable us to get in on the planning of this new facility, and hopefully then, whenever money was available in subsequent years, we would be able to build it and get out of the building that we are currently in that is unsuitable and that the city wants us to vacate.
Senator Cotulla.
Thank you. Yes. Two quick questions. One, is this area the right location for that type of facility? As you presumably,
yes.
Your laboratories
yes,
and samples and everything might find a better home in Anchorage.
At this point, I think the basis on the equipment and the way in which the laboratory operates, being located here is fine. We don't need to be on site necessarily.
It would save us money, would save the department money, would be a better location someplace else than here. Just a question.
I know
the university wants the forest lab and already has some money coming apparently for building, et cetera. But
I have no answer on that. I will research into that to see whether or not there is a more cost-effective location outside of Juneau. At this point, that doesn't appear to be, but I will research that.
It's probably just thinking of Palmer. Senator Fisher?
We do have our
biological
laboratory in Palmer.
Just below here.
Senator Fisher?
The lab itself, it will be shared by three entities, right?
The lab building.
Maintenance, everything else will be shared.
That's right.
Do you have any idea what the maintenance cost would be?
No, I don't. I think the total construction cost would be about $10 million, and I do not know what the maintenance would be.
Okay.
I can do some research in that, too.
Just the last question is then, the equipment will not be shared, though.
Generally, I don't think so, in the sense that each entity would contribute the equipment that they currently have, and I would assume that we could develop research programs together that would share the equipment. As far as future equipment purchases, it would be my intent to see if indeed we could have cost benefits based from any future equipment. It just makes sense that we only need one of the various kinds of machines to conduct the tests, if at all possible.
Any other questions for the commissioner? Senator Halpert?
Yes. Madam Chairman, a couple of the Village Safe Water projects, I think the way we're doing this is probably the least efficient. You know, I know a couple of villages listed that I know that I've flown back and forth through and to for years. Lime Village has probably got about 5 permanent family homes. And we're talking about a $365,000 appropriation, which is $73,000 per family to put in a watering point. Red Devil's probably got about 10 families, which is $43,000 per family to put in a water system. Wouldn't we be better off and a lot of other villages that aren't covered, because you basically picked some and not others, and some of those that are picked are the very smallest of those villages. Wouldn't we be better off to have a system where the state would have a well drilling rig that people in a village could lease and get some kind of a system where they could drill their own wells? I mean, it wouldn't cost $73,000 per family to have somebody go out and drill 5 wells in Lime Village.
I would refer to Gary in terms of how the actual construction occurs. In the Village Safe Water Project, we are indeed the engineers for these projects, which I think does provide for a significant cost saving as opposed to causing each village to have to contract with a private engineer for design, et cetera. As far as the actual conduct of the work, I would defer to Gary on that.
Well, Commissioner Ross is correct, though. We always in the past have received money to give as grants to the communities and never been commissioned to go out and actually buy equipment and build something for them. So that is one way of doing business. It's just the state's chosen to do it another way. In some communities, I know last year in one community, that's what they wanted to do was just buy a drill rig and drill wells, and that was fine with us, and we gave them a grant, and they did that.
Well, it would appear that does the community a lot more good.
Yes.
If you had a large amount of drill rigs on the Kuskokwim and you had a large amount of drill rigs on the Yukon, an awful lot of those villages are accessible by water in season, and just work your way up the river drilling wells in both drainage patterns. And that's an awful lot of the villages that don't have any kind of system or don't have any water. And I can understand their concern when it's going to cost for an individual to get a well in Red Devil. It'll cost them $20,000 by the time they get everything done and get it on a barge, and they've got to work with other people. But there should be some way that DEC can help them coordinate to meet that need.
Madam Chairman, I think that's a good point, and the overall philosophy of the program is to work with the community in the design of the system that they feel will best meet their needs, and also then to attempt to figure out the cheapest way to get it done. And I would certainly take your comments and incorporate them into the responsibilities of the division to assure that the cheapest way is to do it. Now, I don't know if that means the state gets into the drilling business, but it may very well be that we do have some sort of, like you said, just structure so that one rig is on that river that summer and punches wells in 5 different places rather than having 5 different contracts.
Yeah, I'd really like to know if that's possible, Commissioner, because Senator Halpert has hit on, if not an ingenious idea, at least it sounds good. Because the state has big snow rigs, for instance, big snow plows, and we go through and we plow a road, and sometimes we do the Taylor Highway and sometimes we don't. And I think that might be a workable solution, and I'd sure like to have an analysis from DEC to see if it is possible.
Well, you've got a whole bunch of villages on the Kuskokwim that are all strung out together. If you start at Antioch and work your way up through Crooked Creek, Red Devil, Sleepy, on up through there, you could do a lot of good for a lot less money.
Well, let's hear from Senator Ferguson.
The problem with that idea is you'll get the Alaska General Contractors up in uproar because they want to provide the equipment. They want to provide the service to do that. And any time that you're trying to use a piece of government equipment to do something when private enterprise is sitting out there.
They could do it by contract, but the contract be a contract to go through an area and do a, and you know, I'm sure if you've got Southeast villages in the same situation, you could do the same thing in Southeast by barge. But some kind of a pattern, rather than just picking off of a list with no geographic idea of where you go from one transport point to another transport point to another transport point.
It essentially would be, I think, Madam Chairman, you know, a bid package to say the following seven communities are going to get water punched in, and who's willing to bid on that. And there should, I mean, logically, I think we would all agree there probably are some cost savings in having a bid package for seven jobs rather than for seven individual jobs.
To get to Lyon Village with a drill rig, the drill rig is going to have to either come up the Yukon past all the other villages, or it's going to get flown in to one of your others, Red Devil, because that's the only Herc strip in the area. And then it's going to go on a barge from there to Lyon Village. But you're going to, in any case, you're going to pass, you're going to hit Red Devil, Sleep Mute, Stony River to get to Lyon Village. You're going to go by everybody else that's got a problem and spend $300,000, most of which is going to be in transportation and equipment.
Madam Chairman, I, the only caution I would give to this is that given the amount of money that we have, A, we do want to stretch it as far as we can, but B, I think there probably is a sense of geographical distribution in the projects, and you know, I would be reluctant to say that we were going to concentrate on Southeast this year, Northwest next, et cetera. I mean, that's something that obviously the legislature would be, we'd be very interested in terms of how we were concentrating our efforts statewide. But I do think that the idea is well worth examination, and we'll do that.
Senator Cajillo.
Two quick things again. One, Senator Halford does have a good idea, and it will work. Two, if the AGC recognizes that the funding is finite and you could do five villages instead of one, I think there can be some job owning along the way. I think Senator Fergus is right. They've got a pretty good lock on most of us, so that they talk about free enterprise while they're on the public trough and they've got everything but a PCN number themselves. I don't like that duplicity. But the facts of life tend to exist. Senator Ferguson is speaking to them. Nonetheless, something should be arranged so that if there's less money, as many villages as possible could participate in a central water system. When I first grew up in Matanuska Valley, the town of Palmer had one well, and there was one open colonization project. And there was a crib around it, and people pumped the water. Now, the first one was built by the seven farmers that occupied the community because they didn't have time to dig by hand seven wells. And until they had cattle, they used it and packed the water a quarter of a mile, eighth of a mile, whatever it was. And I think some of the same things will have to be true about some of our remote areas that people wish to live in but want to improve their water source. And other areas, as they develop, there'll be 10 wells or a water system for, et cetera. But I think Senator Halford has hit upon something. It works some places. It won't work every place. It'll also follow your criteria. That is, that you're not just going to put work in Southeastern this year. But in fact, with this thing, a fellow might drill four wells during the summer, or three or five wells during the summer, and then next year, with a little more money, leave the equipment that, say, in Red Devil or wherever, and move on up the river again and drill four more the next year. I know some of these career well drillers. A couple more friends of mine. Lawrence Larson is just a typical one. Old Sam Cotton. They'd do that as long as they had a living ahead of them. They're small-time contractors that make their living with one rig. And just like a sawmill, they'll move it around.
Further questions for the commissioner? Further suggestions for the commissioner?
I'd like some kind of a proposal on how you could make some geographic sense out of it. Out of the way the appropriations are implemented. Not just looking at some kind of a political split to hit this and hit that, but to try and make some geographic sense so you can go out there with a pattern that meets the needs of a bunch of communities in a given area. And I think you should look at, you know, the transportation system is the easiest thing to look at, or look at Southeast. Look at where you got water transportation. That's going to be your key.
You start at Cassandra and work your way north.
We will do.
And I think it's also something that you can do that can provide a benefit to a lot of people. It's all the river systems that got people all along the way. And you may be able to have a system whereby in a community, you drill a community well, you also have a chargeback system where an individual lives on the river can pay for a well as you go by,
if they so choose.
Mm-hmm. Senator Ferguson.
I think it's important, and I do support Halford's idea. You take the botulism scare a couple of years ago. We haven't quite gotten over that. But with all the state employees that go out to the bush, and with all the tourists that travel around the state of Alaska, if one community in Alaska spreads disease of hepatitis or diphtheria or anything, I think it's going to hurt the whole state and not just that community. So I think it's important that we try to solve some of these problems.
Madam Chairman, public health and its protection is the highest priority in the department in this program, and we would always keep what Senator Ferguson said in mind.
To Senator Ferguson's point, thank you so much. And God knows the population pressures require good sewer, good water. But for a fraction of what it costs to service those sometimes, so you can service 40 or 50 of these villages too, with a primitive system. And I hope that's always in your prioritization. Mm-hmm. Thinking.
Well, another thing that's going to get to be more and more of a problem is by centralizing, you give people incentive to live where some people don't want to live, and I mean a lot of the local people, and you also build systems where there's a common maintenance responsibility that they have a problem organizing and handling, where if you give them the opportunity to do it individually, they're better off. You know, you take a very small village. I think if you look back at some of those villages that now are going to have to maintain a water system, I think they would be happier if they had wells.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, we attempt to work with each community in terms of setting up what it is that would best suit their needs. I think that's probably true, that there are areas that are now saying, whoops, maybe we should have done it differently. But we don't force people initially into any kind of system. We try to explain the options that are available to them. And in particular, we do stress the maintenance and operation costs that will accrue to whatever facility or whatever process they have established. And within the division, we have a very aggressive program of remote worker training and maintenance. And we attempt to keep those things working out there. I think one of the advantages of the program is not only the sense of accountability for the use of the funds, which is important, I think, but also we do have a follow-up program to assure that we don't just leave the facility out there and then cause the kind of havoc that would occur and come back to the legislature with everybody saying, my water doesn't work, why don't you all fix it? So your point is well taken, and we do try to stress the full range of alternatives that are available and encourage people to pick the one that will suit them the best.
Well, sometimes a major deciding factor is that we're so afraid of giving somebody something individually that we turn around and make a collective group that we think then we can meet a public purpose instead of giving it to an individual. So we spend four times as much to avoid that perception that, yes, you've given somebody a well for his house. As much as that may be inequitable in some senses to all geographic areas of the state, it's going to be a lot cheaper in the long run.
Senator Ferguson?
It's true that the dollar amounts that we have to spend preclude some of those 18 small villages from getting the amount of money that they need. But it's also true that the Eklutna project was left out because of the money problem. Am I correct?
That's right. The governor did not put the Eklutna project in his capital budget.
What I understand very little about the Eklutna project is that if you went 4 days of dry weather in Anchorage right now, they'd run out of water source. And they're on a timeline. And they need the money this year, am I correct?
Yes.
Not next year, because that further delays it by a year, 2 years.
That's my understanding.
So what I'm getting at is, we seem not to have any money, yet we can take the undistributed account, throw it in permanent fund. We can take many accounts, rainy day account, and yet our communities out there are going to suffer because of our need to put things in for a rainy day. When is the rainy day going to be here? This is what I keep asking myself, and I don't seem to get an answer.
Madam Chairman, the comment I would make on that is, I guess Anchorage hopes that there always is a rainy day if they're going to run out of water in 4 sunny days. But also, our programs have always been relatively modest with regards to the total amount of money that the legislature has chosen for water and sewer projects. And You know, we don't anticipate that all projects would go through us. We certainly don't encourage that. We don't have the staffing that would enable us to do that. And obviously the choices as to what goes through us and what in addition goes out to the various communities is the choice that you all make, and we're real comfortable with that.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Not a question, but I would like to follow up that statement with the following. In most categories, I find initiation of projects like Village Center come from the legislature with no leadership at all from the administration. I'd like to see some leadership, including funding leadership from the administration in some of these key things. Quite obviously, there's $100 million worth of immediate need, you know, and why aren't we getting it? It's not your fault. But if you will, every time I find myself under attack, I find, my God, it was the legislature that instituted the program that now people want more of or feel they need more of. And we still don't see any administrative leadership. And the leadership lack there is never reflected in against the administration, but always the dumb legislature, the incompetent legislature. And we started this one, collectively, and expect some follow-up and some funding.
With regards to the municipal grants, I would just offer that besides the accountability that we provide, there is a 50% match requirement at the local level, and there is a sense of fewer state dollars going to providing more services, provided that the local communities can come up with that match. And
we had a 25-75. We had a 25-75, but the governor beat to it.
Senator Lyson, may I make a statement, please? Commissioner Nordale, we are falling behind, ma'am, and I do apologize to you. We're going to release you. You will be first on the list next time, I promise, and I apologize for not getting you today. I'm sorry you had to sit there, but we'll schedule you first next time, okay?
I am
sorry. Senator Lyson?
Madam Chair, just to follow up what Senator Ferguson was speaking about the rainy day account, when that rainy day arrives, those projects that cost us $350,000 now will cost us $700,000.
Madam Chairman, the last item on our capital budget is what's known as the Third International Conference on the Human Environment in Northern Regions.
Oh, yes. What is that, sir?
That is a conference that is... first of all, let me say that the governor's office, in effect, will be responding to that particular item. It has been decided to link that conference up with the Pacific Rim Conference, in effect, and so that all of that would be happening out of the governor's office. And I would assume that Dr. Neve, in his new role as the science advisor, will be responsible for the implementation of this particular conference. I can give you a brief what I know about it, which isn't a whole lot, discussion
well,
of it.
Is this an ongoing thing that Alaska participates in? Is this a new thing?
It's the third conference, Madam Chairman. The first one, I think, was in the late 1960s in Japan, and then there was one in the mid-70s. Or to late 70s in Canada, and then under the previous administration, it was Alaska agreed to host the next one, and it is all of the countries in the northern Arctic rim that come together and discuss the common set of problems and concerns that people have of living in an Arctic climate, and that's the theme of this one, is the human environment.
Excuse me, Commissioner, Alaska has agreed...
Yes,
at some past time to host this conference. So we really are on the hook for this.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Yes. Senator Halpern.
Who agreed?
Pardon?
Who agreed?
It was the previous Commissioner Mueller was the one who I think the trans... And there was an item in the budget last year with regards to this. I think it was $75,000 to do the initial planning of the conference. It's supposed to be in this September.
Senator Halpern.
Is there any potential of... other sources of funds, i.e. private funds or anything else that we can augment this with?
Again, you're getting into a level of detail about the conference that I'm not real familiar with. I do know that in my previous position in Washington, D.C., I did seek additional funding at the federal level from the National Science Foundation or from EPA and its international connections and was unable to secure additional funding. And I'm not sure how much the entire conference is going to cost. I think there are other funding sources, so to speak, that have gone into it. But again, I would have to defer to the governor's office in any detailed discussion of that item.
Could you request from them or provide to us, in any case get it provided to us, an accounting of the total cost, regardless of what component it is in that conference, and how that money is to be expended?
I will get you a copy of the budget.
Okay, now remember there's $750,000 for the Pacific Rim Conference, and the commissioner has told us they're going to be joined together.
In some loose fashion, Madam Chairman, I wouldn't, you know, I don't understand quite the language, but I think it's going to be sort of like consecutive timing, et cetera, because many of the people who would participate in the Pacific Rim Conference might very well be the ones who would participate in this as well.
Senator Eliason.
Madam Chair, are you saying that there's a possibility that this $250,000, which is going to be for that purpose, could be maybe reappropriated into maybe a little water or sewer system in one of the villages?
No, I didn't say that. And a choice like that would have to be up to the legislature. But I would urge you all, before you make any decisions about that, to hear the more full presentation from the governor's office on the conference.
Commissioner, we thank you. I need to report to you, sir, that the Legislative Lounge now has a sneeze guard over its food, and we put in a chain across so that we can't go back and dabble in the food. Our instructions from your person who came through and almost failed us.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate the changes that you've made, and I want you to know that I was at a restaurant here locally last night, and given that I have a cold, I recognized over the salad bar the need for the sneeze guard. So I think that's a very wise decision that you've made. I'd also like to say that for better or for worse, and in most instances I think for the better, the system does work. When I read in the newspaper that this inspection had occurred, I did inquire as to whether or not the division director was aware of it. He said no. He went down to the next level. They said no. And indeed, it was just the person doing their anointed rounds, and the lounge was next on the list. And I feel real good about the way the whole thing happened and the way in which the legislature has responded. And I think the public health of you all, we need all of you healthy, given you only have a 120-day session.
That's right, and so, if they're not healthy, they blame it on the lounge and me. So I want them healthy, too. Commissioner,
thank you very much
for participating today.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee.
Any other meeting or news or business coming for the committee? Meeting adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen. This morning, because of the teleconferencing and because we have witnesses in Anchorage who would like to testimony, who would like to testify, the order for the bills this morning will be Senate Bill 152, Royalty Oil Sales Approval. We'll hear from Senator Jack Coghill, Commissioner of Natural Resources Esther Warnocke, Assistant Attorney General Steve Porter, who is with us in Anchorage, and Kay Brown, Director of Oil and Gas, who is with us in Anchorage. Then we'll go to House Bill 134, Disaster Relief for Haines Sewer System. Then we'll get into the ATC bill, Senate Bill 103, Safety Laws for Motor and Air Carriers. With that, I'd like to bring Senator Jack Coghill forward, please. Give us his statement on Senate Bill 152. Senate Bill 152 extends the GVEA royalty oil contract for 3 months. They got into a bind between the expiration of their old contract and the startup of a new contract that won't come before the legislature for approval until March 8th. So because of the time frame necessary in notifying the producers of a shutoff or a continuation of oil, they've got themselves in a situation that there will be a disruption of oil if this bill is not approved. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I introduced this legislation on the suggestion and the request of the council, as well as for the council, as well as constituency of the utility that services the interior of Alaska. Golden Valley and the state negotiated a contract in 1976 for 5,000 barrels of royalty oil per day, and Golden Valley has just renewed their contract. However, the time frame in producing the contract is going to fall short of the procedure, and I think that Commissioner Warnocke could probably evaluate the time frame on that. But as I understand it, that if the royalty oil, if you don't have a contract for royalty oil, you have to notify the producers that the oil is not going to be sold, and it goes back into their mainstream. The new contract for Golden Valley is not a part of this issue. This issue is only to continue so that the procedural part of Golden Valley's contract, the old contract, just extended. Now, when we first introduced it, why, we just had one sentence in here that said just basically that, and then after we got done with it, why, we had to have our attorney suggested that we do it this way, because under this bill, it's a legislative process where we're following three basic structures for 3 months, and then the bill automatically terminates the end of September, and it accomplishes what we want to get done. And I urge the committee to pass it. I think that if you take a look at the dollar value of it, like if we had to go through the whole procedural part of undoing the oil and then doing it again for the 3 months, that we would lose quite a bit of money.
Are there any questions for Senator Coghill from the committee? Thank you, Senator Coghill. Commissioner Warnocke?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We have reviewed the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 152.
Okay, Commissioner Warnocke, for the record, please. The Secretary's getting mad at me unless we have everybody identify themselves.
I'm sorry. I'm Esther Warnocke, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Madam Chairman. And we have reviewed the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 152, which would allow us to extend the current royalty oil contract with Golden Valley Electric Association for a three-month period. We have no objection to the bill. We've provided the committee with a proposed extension agreement, which I'm prepared to execute upon enactment of the legislation and approval by the governor. And as you mentioned earlier, Kay Brown, who is the director of oil and gas in my department, is on the teleconference, as is Steve Porter from the Attorney General's office, if you have any questions. That's all I have, Madam Chairman.
Any questions to the commissioner?
Just one question.
Senator Curtula.
It's been my understanding the state's provision of royalty oil, in this case, is not a subsidy from the state. We don't take less money for our product.
The state is getting more than it would get if it left the oil in value.
30 cents a barrel or something.
Yes, sir.
And you certify that as a fact?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions to the commissioner?
Madam Chairman, I might have one minor correction, if I may. I believe it will be the 11th of March before we'll be able to submit to the legislature the negotiated contract that has just been before the Royalty Board for a longer-term contract with Golden Valley Electric.
Senator Halford.
I think I'll ask the director of
You do not have a question for the commissioner at this time? Are there any other questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner Warnicki.
Thank you, madam.
All right, who would the committee like to hear from? Kay Brown, Director of Division of Oil and Gas, or Steve Porter, Assistant AG?
I've got a question for Kay Brown.
Okay, Kay Brown, would Senator Halpert has a question for you, please.
Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I wonder if you could explain why we have a time constraint on this contract and what the effect of approving a three-month extension is in terms of those time constraints.
Peter, are you asking why we're late getting it down here?
Affirmative. Why do we have the gap? Why wasn't it negotiated sooner?
Senator Halpert, there was a long period or a period of several months in which the negotiations were stalemated, basically over the issue of the AMROT HES adjustments. We had made every effort to complete that work by early October so that we would be able to get it to you early in the session. However, that was not possible, and it did take us several more months to resolve that particular issue.
Everybody involved was aware that there was a deadline, and this would be the result if it weren't done by October?
Yes.
Are there further questions for Kay Brown? Senator Paul Fisher?
Thank you. Good morning, Kay. The question I have, maybe, I don't know if you can answer it or not, but I guess a concern I have is there any difference? I know we're going to have to bring in a third party, but in the case of MAPCO, if the price of oil that we're now getting under this contract, if it were the same as other in-state refineries pay, I assume it's not, but if there is a difference, what would that difference be on added revenue to MAPCO for 450,000 barrels? Do you know that offhand?
No, I'd say first that the price they are paying now and would pay under the new contract is very similar to the other price terms in the other contracts. Tesoro does pay a 35-cent premium. However, they do not have a price reopener for 6 years. In the GDEA contract, there is a price reopener in every 2 years. So the 30 cents and a price reopener every 2 years is consistent with the department's most recent contracts. There are some old contracts where the parties pay less, such as the long-term MAPCO contract.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions to Kay or Steve Porter? Senator Halpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question is relative to value. The contract provides more than taking in value. What does it provide as compared to one of the backup contracts on royalty taking by another taker?
Senator Halpert, the price term in the backup contract is structured somewhat differently because we wanted to avoid the uncertainties of the litigation hanging over the bidding. Therefore, we came up with a different method for doing that with the backup contract. They're not directly comparable, and there's some difference between the end value and the base price that we established under the backup contracts. And then, of course, the backups have a premium bid on top of a base price. The base price is somewhat higher than the end value.
Are there any other questions? What is the will of the committee?
I'll move the bill out with individual recommendation, Chairperson.
The CS from Resources?
Yes, committee substitute for Senate Bill 152 without recommendation.
Senator Krutula has moved CS for Senate Bill 152 Resources out of the committee with individual recommendations. Are there any objections? All right, so moved. Thank you, Senator Krutula. Thank you, Kay and Steve. We appreciate you being on board this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay, yes. We'll stand at ease for 2 minutes. The next bill before us is House Bill 134. It's an act authorizing the expenditure of no more than $1.6 million from the Disaster Relief Fund for a sewer system failure in the city of Haines. This bill would authorize the expenditure of an additional $600,000 out of the Disaster Relief Fund for rehabilitation work to the city of Haines' sewer system. This fund, the Disaster Relief Fund, is administered by the Department of Military Affairs, and under law, the governor may not expend more than $1 million from the disaster fund without legislative authorization. The funds would pay for rehabilitation work as identified by the Department of Environmental Conservation and can be grouped into four main areas. Construction of two sewage bypasses to keep sewage off the streets and prevent flooding of the sewage treatment plant for approximately $20,000. The extension of the sewage discharge point to remove sewage from the downtown shoreline for approximately $250,000. And rehabilitation of the existing sewer system to correct a high flow rate to the treatment plant, which causes the sewer system to flood city streets at approximately $697,000. The administrative costs associated with this is $323,000. And for the information of the committee, I have some questions on the administrative costs here. They seem rather excessive. Senator Eliason, would you like to have a statement concerning
Madam Chairman, I think the cover letter of January 28th from the governor's office pretty well outlines the problem. We have a member here from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Alex Vitry, who has been on the scene, would probably fill us in on the situation.
Okay. Would Alex Vitry please come forward? Did Representative Gall make it? Okay. For the record, sir. Good morning.
I'm Alex Vitry, an environmental engineer with the Department of Environmental Conservation. And if I could start with answering any questions you might have with the administrative services costs on this bill. I developed the cost estimate for this project and must apologize for some of the errors in presentation that I made with the administrative services costs that make it look so inflated. In fact, those costs aren't as high as they would at first appear based on the sheet that you have before you.
Could you tell us what they are then? The state of Alaska oversight at $10,000. Is that accurate?
Yes, ma'am, it is. Madam Chairman, that is correct. That oversight charge is basically travel and any other expenses that may occur resulting from going on the scene and inspecting construction as it's proceeding or auditing the books of the City of Haines on their administration of the funds.
Now, City of Haines administrative and contract costs at $119,000. Could you explain that to us, sir, please?
Yes, Madam Chairman. That $119,000 is actually should be a floating figure. The City of Haines, first of all, let me back up for a second. The City of Haines has volunteered on their own to absorb these costs, if need be, to the extent that they are financially able. The intent of that $119,000 was to offset any additional staff that the city may have to hire in overseeing the construction program that we have presented here before us. The intent of the $119,000 then is to pay for additional work staff for the construction of item 3, rehabilitation of the existing system, should the city choose to do that on their own versus going out to a contractor, and or to pay for any additional staff that the city may have to hire to foresee and oversee this project. So I guess my answer to your question would be that a certain percentage of that cost is indeed administrative services, but some portion of that cost will also be for the construction of the rehabilitation. If we added the $10,000 from the state oversight, the $119,000 for the City of Haines, and the $4,000 independent certified public accountant, you would get $133,000, which is 8.3% for administrative services. The remaining 11.8%, that is the $120,000 contingencies and the $70,000 project engineer costs, are not true administrative services costs. The $120,000 contingency is a piggy bank of sorts that we have included in the estimate to cover any unforeseen errors in unit cost estimates or to cover any expenses that we may encounter in the field that need to be taken care of. The $70,000 project manager costs are for the hiring of a quality control engineer who will be at the site and ensure that the installation of these rehabilitation projects are done in a fashion that is professionally adequate. The City of Haines does not have such an engineer on their staff, and I would suspect that you would call that as a contract engineer, and I don't think that's a true administrative cost. That's a program cost. So that would bring the total administrative services cost to 8.3%, which is very reasonable considering a cost of this size.
Any questions? Senator Petula?
Since the City of Haines doesn't have an engineer, and since the state's providing that engineer, what are our liabilities if that engineering work is not properly done? They make gross errors in judgment. I'm just curious.
Madam Chairman, the state of Alaska, in its role with this program, is responsible for ensuring that the plans and specifications of the job are adequate and appropriate for the need. I have done several site visits to the location. Part of these costs ensure that a study will be done to prioritize the work in the proper fashion, that we'll get the right work done as efficiently and as quickly as possible. We also have a compliance order by consent that the City of Haines has signed with us. The state, in essence, does not have an obligation to assure itself that the problem will be solved. The City of Haines does. We will do everything we can to ensure that that is done, and if it is not, we have legal mechanisms available to ensure that it is done.
Ultimately, then, what you're saying is that we're providing, but the City of Haines itself is accepting and is liable for any mistakes that our engineer may possibly make. Presumably, he's not going to make any, but we don't have liability at all.
That's right.
That's good. Thank you.
Senator Halford. Senator Paul Fisher.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I just have a question on the piggy bank that we're referring to. Is your agency going to monitor that so in the event we don't need the whole $100,000, the rest will lapse back into the general fund or back into the account?
Our particular agency does not do that. The Division of Emergency Services, through, I believe, the Division of Military and Veterans Affairs, will be handling the money expenditure itself. And they have various requirements for what money can be used where, when, and why. The contingency fund is, of course, if we need an extra manhole someplace, or if a compressor wasn't thought of and they need to buy one, we'll buy it with that amount of funds. It's not intended for anything other than construction costs.
And, Madam Chairman, just to follow up, so I'm making the assumption that we know exactly what needs to be, so if there's 20 manholes, we don't look around and find another one somewhere else because we have the money. I mean, the project has been well-defined at this point, right?
Yes, that's okay. Correct. The project is pretty well defined right now.
Senator Halford and Senator Eliason.
In terms of format, does this basically end up as a municipal grant?
Madam Chairman, this does not really align itself in terms of a grant. That is to say that the same regulatory structure that you would have under a grant program is not applicable in this particular case. This is an emergency fund. And if I may, I would rather defer the way that this fund is overseen to Jack Sharp from the Division of Emergency Services, who is here in the audience. That's not my area of expertise, and I don't want to mislead the
committee. Senator Halford?
Okay, another question that would go along with that would be what the conditions are for lapse of excess funds. With a $120,000 contingency fund, and a contract which is, or a proposal, which by its emergency nature probably estimates high to make sure it can get done, I would expect that there should be a lapse. And I'd kind of like to know how that lapse would be handled.
We'll call Mr. Sharp up in just one moment. Senator Eliason?
Mr. Chairman, I think the last, in the information I had before, it pretty well addresses how they're handling the estimates. It's not intended as an engineer's estimate. At the present time, I just update on what's happening up there. That they have put in two bypass systems, which are unfortunately emptying in close to the boat harbor. And they've signed a contract for design work, plans and specifications. They'll be done this Friday, and they'll be ready to advertise immediately after the passage of the bill. So they are progressing.
Are there any other questions for DEC? Senator
Halford?
We're
going to have somebody from disaster. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jack Sharp from Emergency Services. For the record, would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Jack Sharp. I'm an Emergency Management Officer with the Alaska Division of Emergency Services. And I have Mr. Richard Roundtree, Director of the Department of Administrative Affairs and Administrative and Support Division.
Senator Halford.
How is this funding handled in terms of lapse? Does it become an appropriation that's just an open appropriation like any other capital budget appropriation without any lapse date, or how is it handled?
Yes, I can answer that question. What we do is we draw an allocation of the disaster relief fund, and you're authorized, if this passes, you're authorized us to expend up to $1.6 million. It doesn't mean the whole amount goes out there for expenditure. It has to be, we analyze bills and monitor that this money is spent in accordance with the regulations and also the scope of the work. And any money not used never comes out of the disaster relief fund. All we have is an allocation out of that disaster relief fund for this purpose. It's not used, it's never drawn out. So as far as lapsing goes, we only draw what we need out of the fund, as we need it on a course account type thing.
Okay, and how long does the authorization to draw out of it last? For example, if they go out to contract and they're working on the job and they're done by June 30th, does that authorization automatically disappear, or does that authorization remain there? And if there's a major storm and a problem in July and they need to fix some more manholes or whatever, they go ahead and do it?
It would be once the scope of the work is completed or upon June 30th, 1986. And they have that to that point up to complete the project. Or if it's completed sooner, why, that's it. I think the whole key to it here is the scope of the work as it's laid out, is what you're getting at here. And there wouldn't be any lapse. We just wouldn't draw out only what we need.
Are there any other questions for these gentlemen? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The question was raised earlier that the rainy day account, which is where the expenditure for the disaster relief comes from, very specifically says it's for operating expenses only. The disaster relief fund in this project is for capital expenditures. We've contacted the Attorney General's office, Jim Baldwin, who says there's absolutely no problem, the law is broad enough to fund this. He's in a meeting right now. He is willing to be called down, but he assures us there's absolutely no problem with that at all. If the committee would like to wait and hear from Mr. Baldwin, that's certainly possible. Senator Halford?
I have a question you may be able to answer, having talked to Mr. Baldwin.
You now know all I know.
Well,
I like that as a matter of record.
I'm sorry, Senator Halford. What's your question?
Well, the question is the rainy day account available for a capital expenditure because that capital expenditure is in one of the specific funds in the rainy day account, or is the rainy day account definition broad enough to allow that expenditure, regardless of account?
I think it's your first one, and that's a question you'd have to specifically ask for Mr. Baldwin. Senator Curtula?
Chairperson, I'd be satisfied, personally, not just must speak for myself, not to delay this legislation, if the Finance Committee would write a letter to Mr. Baldwin with the Halford questions and ask him for a written answer. I think that might be of service.
Okay, for possibly floor presentation?
Yes.
Are there any objections to the committee from having a written opinion from Mr. Baldwin on this issue? Senator Halford?
I think the statute is clear. The section which deals with operating costs is under B, and it says in the provision that sets up the disaster relief, notwithstanding the provisions of B of this section, the governor may transfer up to $5,000. So it's a specific exemption to the operating cost thing also.
What is the pleasure of the committee? Senator Curtula?
I'd move may substitute for House Bill 134 out with individual recommendation. Ask and ask consent.
And it would be the CS from the Finance Committee.
CS for by Finance.
Right. Any objections to moving CS for House Bill 134 Finance out of the Senate Finance Committee with individual recommendations? Hearing none, well, so do that.
Chairperson, I have a comment.
Yes, Senator Petula.
Two quick ones. One, probably, and this probably is law, this format, but probably our fiscal notes ought to have an other under it or something, so it does indicate that someplace or other the taxpayer has contributed rather than zeros, just because it doesn't fit the categories above. Obviously, it's not operating, but it is a disaster relief fund, and probably be wise for a fiscal note to carry what the bill carries, because some constituents are going to say, how can it be zero, and justifiably say that.
Okay. With your permission, Senator Petula, Senator Sackett, how would that work? Would that be okay to do that?
I'm sorry, what is
that? On the fiscal note, where it says all zeros for the Haynes bill, mm-hmm. to put down that this is really an appropriation from the disaster relief fund. So redo the fiscal note to show that.
Right.
Is there anything wrong with that?
No.
Great. Okay. Thank you. We'll do that, Senator.
One other thing that occurred to me that I want to speak to, because this is the appropriate moment, I think. Disaster Relief Fund, when we had the flood in Fairbanks, subsequent to the disaster with the earthquake in Anchorage environs, Walter Hickel, then governor, proposed a disaster relief fund that we all contributed annually $10 to. It was a follow-up of the old poll tax that went to education. And in our newfound wealth, we wiped out all those programs. But this just seems to be a place where the Finance Committee ought to consider reinstituting an across-the-board small contribution from everybody to keep this disaster relief fund alive in a separate entity. And I just mentioned it because I'll probably reintroduce that legislation and the Finance Committee to think about it.
Any other comments? All right, fine. Moving on to Senate Bill 103. Senate Bill 103 concerns the department, the demise of the Alaska Transportation Commission. This bill sets up insurance funding mechanism. For those of you, I just spotted Jim Baldwin has come into the audience. Are there any lingering questions for Mr. Baldwin? Okay, Jim, we're going to ask you to do it for us in writing for the floor. All right? Great. Thank you for coming down. The ATC, Senate Bill 103, sets up an insurance section for both truck carriers and aircraft carriers, or air carriers, and it sets up a safety program for all trucks in the state of Alaska weighing more than 10,000 pounds. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senate Bill 103 by the Transportation Committee was condensed down from its original bill. The original bill that the governor's bill that came down was basically a liftoff of a lot of the regulations from ATC and set them over into safety. We have, through the process in the Senate Transportation Committee, took a good hard look at the full text of the initiative that did the demise on ATC, and we established a financial responsibility part to the bill, and we provided for a truck inspection, and the inspection not through a series of state inspectors, but through the private sector, where that we would license people in the private sector to do the inspection of the vehicles. We feel that committee substitute for Senate Bill 103 follows the dictates of the initiative that was passed in November. We feel that the tying it down in this bill the way we did, where we took the transportation factors of the air carrier and the motor carrier and put them together, we made a strong bill out of it, and that we capped it so that the overzealous people in government would not be able to, just under the guise of regulations, put back all of the stringent provisions that the ATC had in their operation. And the bill has a fiscal note, and you have on your agenda the 171, which is the committee's bill to transfer all the rest of the money that ATC had over to Commerce so that they could do the job. I'll answer any questions, Madam Chairman.
Senator Petula.
The provision which worries me a bit is the provision of private inspection. Do you have that person bonded, heavily bonded, the inspector that will do the inspection upon trucks and so on? Is he heavily bonded, and are there serious liabilities that he incurs if he ignores his responsibilities once he accepts the responsibility of inspection? I think you have to have the ability to move right in, Senator Coghill, and if somebody's doing a bad job, you know, nail him. And he ought to be bonded to ensure further that he would do a job of inspection. And I'm just curious if we've done something. It seems to me when the private sector moves into a public responsibility, you have to have those protections for the public.
We had a bond in there in one of our drafts, Senator Cotula, and I'm not too sure that we kept that total bond thing in there. But we have it where that the department or the Department of Commerce and Economic Development is going to monitor these people.
Senator Coghill, yes. I don't think there's a bond left in the bill.
I think we took it out. I think it was taken out in our committee that somebody required, and I have no objection if the bond went back, but I share your views on that. And we do have strong language in here where, though, the inspector is certified, and if it falls back to him, he can have his certification taken.
Follow-up, Senator Cotula.
It's just that the point of using private inspectors may go into automobile inspection and so on in time to come with population increase. And if we set up a good system now and boilerplated it and was satisfactory, we might save the state a lot of money later and still do the service that's needed.
Senator,
if we screw around, you know, make a mistake now, the public will not accept this type of approach. If you've got a good approach, I'm just would like to see it boilerplated up front. That's all, sir.
Senator, we did have, Madam Chairman, we sent a letter of intent along with the bill where we realize that there's some inequities and that there's, because of the time constraints that we're under to try and get this bill through, that we suggested that the Transportation Committee follow through with this whole scenario for a year, both in the air carrier and in the motor carrier, and that we report back to the session 10 days after we start our second session. Because we know that there are some areas here that are just not necessarily the way we like them.
Senator Curtillo.
I'll get off it. Even with the state inspection and state weighing and so on, I know of one truck, one oil truck, having nothing to do with any private, it was just a privately owned truck that didn't have brakes and knew they didn't have brakes and still moved on with the load. And that's the sort of thing you're trying to do what you can to, from time to time, to inspect and so on to prevent.
Senator Halfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, we're trying to figure out which inspection system stays in. It looks like the drafting of the bill provides two inspections per year for every truck over 10,000 pounds, be that public carrier, private carrier, farm, contractor, rural areas, urban areas, wherever you are in the state, to be legal to operate on the highway system, you have to have two inspections a year.
Senator Cargill?
We tried to address this, as you well know, in the Transportation Committee, and on page 7, under the commercial purposes, we had a large definition, and it got cut back. And it says the commercial purposes mean something for which a person receives direct monetary compensation. And so a farm vehicle would not be, in my estimation, under this because it would not be direct monetary compensation. He would be hauling his produce, his production. And the same way with a bakery truck or a delivery truck, it would not be under that because you would not be getting, quote, a direct monetary, you would be getting an indirect. And we had that in there, but it, in the wisdom of the committee, they cut it out. So I would say, no, you're wrong, Senator.
I couldn't find where you've done that. It does apply to all areas of the state where there's a state highway.
Wherever there's a state highway and a state highway maintained, and yes.
Any further questions for Senator Coghill? Senator Halford.
Does it apply to municipal vehicles?
Yes, sir.
The municipalities have to hire a inspector to inspect their vehicles, and they're covered in the same way anyone else is.
Why shouldn't they be, Senator? Okay. Safety factors. State and municipal vehicles should carry the same burden as the private sector.
Well, state vehicles don't in this bill.
Federal don't.
State and federal are exempted, aren't they?
Okay.
I read that right.
Excuse me.
Only
Senator
federal?
Coghill, I think the commercial purposes only relates to the insurance part. The safety inspections relate to every truck, no matter what. It's a statewide safety program, sir. I believe that's the way the bill is written now. Commercial purposes is just for the insurance. And someone correct me if I'm wrong. Joe Swanson back there is nodding his head. Your staff is nodding their head. We went back and forth so many times on it, Senator, but I think the version that's before us right now is listed that way. We relieved the financial burden on the insurance part of it, but we did make a statewide safety inspection program for every truck in the state.
Over 10,000 pounds,
yes,
that operates on a highway.
Yes, sir.
And I think that the rationale behind that was, why not?
Any further questions for Senator Coghill? Senator Halper.
Yeah, the question then comes, when does this have to all be done? In terms of the safety inspection, at what time is a truck illegal on the road if it hasn't had an inspection?
When do we have the inspection?
Yeah.
As soon as the inspection program is put into effect and we have the certification? Are you asking, has it got to be done immediately? Does every truck have to be inspected on the first day of March?
Well,
Senator Halford, those questions may be more apropos to Joe Swanson of Division of Measurements and Standards or Weights and whatever he is.
Okay.
Any further questions to Senator Coghill? Senator Halford.
Yeah, in the aircraft insurance section, there's on page 3, we require in-state insurance and filing of intrastate carriers if they have any segment in-state. I assume that's Western, Alaska Airlines, and Mark Air. And I wonder if that section has been checked to make sure that I think they carry much
more
insurance.
They carry way more than that. We checked that. But they carry way more than that in the international.
But the question is, this is done by aircraft.
That is
and
correct.
It may mean that every one of their aircraft, regardless of whether they necessarily come to Alaska normally, is going to have a separate insurance rider with a notification provision and 30 days cancellation to a state agency if they're going to have to substitute that aircraft on Alaska route at any point.
But we have in here on page 2, we have that provision that set line 7 where the insurance proof of insurance that it falls on the anniversary date of the insurance. In other words, it slides on.
Yeah, I'm
Senator Halford.
I guess my question is, do we need to have that for the big carriers? Are they going to not carry $300,000 a seat? They carry policies so much bigger than that, do they?
Well, if they're carrying more, Senator Halford, if they're carrying more, well, it's moot.
I just wonder why we need it.
It covers them, but if they're carrying more, so it's moot.
Yes.
You're covering them. You want to exempt them and then not have it?
No, it's a filing is what I'm concerned with. Whether we need the filing from Alaska Airlines, from Western, and from Mark Air, at $50 for any airplane that may come to Alaska. Anyway.
Any further questions to Senator Coghill? Thank you, sir. Joe Swanson, Division of Weights and Measures. Joe, now you get all the hard questions for
Thank
the record,
you, Senator,
sir, please.
Madam Chairman. Would the chair like me to go through the fiscal note or just
No, I'd
answer
like you
questions?
To state your name first, please.
Joe Swanson, Director of Measurement Standards.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Would you tell us how the safety inspection part of the bill works, sir?
As we envision, and maybe I'll start this off by answering your question, Senator Halford. We envision there is a requirement in the bill that prior to an individual being able to receive his registration, he has to show proof that he's had an inspection. So our intent was that would be our target date if we got the program. In other words, January 1, because that's when large commercial vehicles are registered. We would see that every vehicle in the state was registered or we have provided the opportunity through the inspection stations. Does that answer that question? So January 1 was our target date.
Well, what's the law required when it's drafted?
The way it's drafted is very difficult for me to. It right now, it says that you must have your vehicle inspected twice a year, and that you must have a certificate of compliance on the side of the vehicle. I think we would be stretching it if we said that on March 1st everybody had to have that sticker. I don't believe that was the intent of the bill. I think we can get around it. The real crux comes when each individual owner of that vehicle goes to DMV to get his registration or license for next year. At that time, he has to show proof, and that was the target date we were using.
Okay, as long as the bill gives you the leeway to do that, I didn't see any way that we could, like, effective date was phased to allow that to happen. That's what I was concerned about.
Okay, right now, the thing that's illegal is to drive down the road without the sticker. And it probably would not be a bad idea if you said that every vehicle must have this the sticker by January 1, 1986. I can't believe that the state troopers and the local city police would go out and stop every vehicle between now and then, and I can assure you we're not going to. The verbiage would not be a bad idea.
Well,
it was not the intent of the division, though, to enforce this thing until January 1, 1986. It was our intent to begin immediately to establish the inspection stations and to start certifying the individual inspectors. Am I answering your questions, Senator?
Well, yeah, the problem I think you would have is with a liability case where, in fact, someone didn't have an inspection in July of this year and were involved in an accident, and either his insurance carrier or someone else said that you, in fact, were a trespasser on the highway, you were not following the state laws, you were required to be inspected and weren't, and therefore you're liable for whatever the accident was because you weren't supposed to be there. And number two, your insurance doesn't carry because you hadn't complied with state law.
My recommendation then to the committee would be to add verbiage into the bill that would say that all vehicles must be stickered by January 1, 1986. And that would give us in the division the time to get the inspection stations and the individuals certified. Really, where the real rush is going to be is in the second half of next year. Would you like me now to go through the process, Madam Chair?
I don't know. Does the committee need to hear the process for the safety inspection? Senator Paul Fisher?
Just a question. No. The time limit that's done by regulation versus that. Do you feel that regulations are not flexible enough that you should do regulations, say, 1091? Do you feel that it's
not? Well, unless we initiated emergency regulations, it will take us 6 to 8 months to go through the regulatory process. We could be as far as January 1. Recognizing that the law requires that we hold hearings in those communities that will be affected. And certainly every community in the state is going to be affected, and any regulations on this particular bill will have to be held in at least 3 communities, if not 5. And we have the requirements to post everything in the paper, then we have to come back to the legislature for approval, we have to go to the AG for approval. And it takes us almost a year to process regulations unless we do it on an emergency basis. So from that standpoint, even if we said yes, we could address it in regulation, I think we're looking at the same time constraints. The way we envision this particular piece of the safety program itself, the way the bill's currently written, all state and municipal governments fall under the safety portion of the